Thank you. And counsel, have you had the opportunity to read the court's handout about oral argument procedures? And do you have any questions about any of that? If not, we're ready to proceed on Hicks versus, and is it Jundeff? Is it Jundeff?
Please the court. I am Larry Hamill, admission number 4143, and with me at council table is Alicia Smith, who has joined on the briefs. We're here on behalf of Dr. and Mrs. Jundeff and City Mortgage, which is the mortgage holder on the property that's been referred to in the pleadings and briefs in this case as the Glenmore property. I will not bore the court with the long and tortured history of the Glenmore property and the various cases that have involved this lien and the rights of various parties with respect to this lien. We're here on a very narrow issue this morning. And that issue is whether or not due process has been afforded to Dr. Jundeff and to City Mortgage. We contend that it was not afforded to them and that as a result, the revival order, which revived the judgment lien in this case held by Mr. Hicks, was void as a matter of law and must be vacated.
Counsel, does the due process issue require a finding of indispensability of your client?
The two are interrelated, Judge Criswell. I think if you are an indispensable party, which I believe we are in this case, then you are required to have due process.
Well, do you have any authority for the proposition that the rule requiring joinder of indispensable parties applies post-judgment?
The rule that requires the joinder of indispensable parties post-judgment is not what really is at issue here, because what is at issue here is not the judgment itself.
Well, I understand that, but these are post-judgment proceedings.
Correct, Your Honor, and if they're to have any implication for City Mortgage and Jundeff's, then they must be afforded due process.
Well, is the answer to my question no, you don't have authority for the proposition that the rule requiring joinder of indispensable parties applies to post-judgment proceedings?
Your Honor, we entered this proceeding as an indispensable party on order of the court and with the consent of the Hicks parties. I don't believe that's
an intervener.
As an intervener, that's correct.
My question is simply whether or not there is a requirement of indispensable joinder of indispensable parties after judgment is entered.
If there is a determination that affects these parties, yes, they are indispensable to that determination, not the original action.
And where do I go to find the answer to that?
I think you go to Rule 19, Your Honor.
Nothing beyond that.
I don't know that there is anything beyond Rule 19 and the law of due process.
Okay.
There can be no question that this proceeding, this stage of the proceeding, affected the property interests of City Mortgage and Dr. and Mrs. Jundeff. That being the case, whether it is post-judgment or pre-judgment, that's really not the issue. The issue is this order itself, not the judgment.
We test it then by principles of due process, not by the rule itself.
Well, I think the rule is implicit. Due process is implicit in the rule.
Okay.
Which says that if you have an interest in property, you must be joined as a party to the proceeding.
Okay.
Dr. and Mrs. Jundeff and City Mortgage were not parties to this proceeding. They were not subject to the jurisdiction of this court. They had never consented to be subject to the jurisdiction of this court. But this portion of the proceeding clearly affected their property interests. That being the case, under either the principles of due process or Rule 19, they should have been joined. They must be joined. Because if there is a determination without their right to appear with due notice, then that determination is void as a matter of law. And we've cited a number of cases that hold that position to be true, and not the least of which is the Flaner case.
Mr. Hamill, let me ask you a question. You have asserted that the Jundeff's and City Mortgage's property interests have been affected by this proceeding to revive the lien.
Yes, sir.
Of Mr. Hicks. Right, Mr. Hicks. How was their property interest adversely affected?
By the extension of the lien, which otherwise would have lapsed. When they took title to this property, and much was made by the trial court that their position is exactly the same as it was when they took title to the property. That simply is not true. When they took title to the property, they were subject to a lien that would expire by its own terms within 6 years. This extended that lien another 6 years and has continued to cloud the title to their property.
Okay, let me, the next question following that is, if your clients had been served with a notice of this motion to revive the lien and extend the lien, what would they have asserted as an objection or an argument that the lien should not be extended?
Well, that's really not the issue, Your Honor, but to address that question, they would have asserted the invalidity of the lien. There is an argument that sort of threads its way through the defendant.
They would have challenged the underlying judgment?
They would have.
That's what you're saying?
That would have been the basis for attacking the lien. That's correct.
Under Rule 60?
Under Rule 60, no, Your Honor. The judgment was entered, we believe, the evidence established that the judgment was entered as a result of duress and fraud. And so we would have attacked it on that basis.
How could you under Rule 60? Had the time limit run for that?
The rule, no, it had not run for that because that would have been a void judgment. And under Rule 60B3, void judgments are not subject to the time limitations under Rule 60. But that is really not the issue. I know that that's the issue that they've stressed in their brief, but that is not the issue. If you took that approach, the no harm, no foul approach, to the issue of due process of law, you could get a judgment against me without giving any notice. On a promissory note, the bank comes in and gets a judgment on me without ever serving me. I go in, I find out this judgment exists. There's a lien on my property. I go in to set that judgment aside under Rule 60B3, and they say, well, wait a minute, you didn't have a defense to that judgment in the first place, therefore no harm, no foul, no constitutional problem.
But there is not one. We're talking about jurisdiction in that, in your example.
We're talking about jurisdiction precisely in this example, too, Your Honor. The June Defs and City Mortgage were not subject to the jurisdiction of the trial court here. And by the way, to address the earlier question you asked me about post-judgment indispensability, if you take a look at Hidden Lake Development, that was one that, a Rule 106 proceeding, where the original zoning matter was decided adversely to a homeowners association group of property owners. They filed a lawsuit under Rule 106 within 30 days, but not naming the proper parties. That lawsuit, because it was not named in the proper parties, was ultimately dismissed. And the trial court, the Court of Appeals, rather, ruled that the fact that that proceeding was now barred because of the post-judgment, if you will, action, was not relevant. But the issue was that if you're going to file a lawsuit, if you're going to seek to determine parties' interests in property, you must give them due process of law.
But that again involved the court's jurisdiction, right?
But that's exactly what we have here, Judge Griswold.
But the court acquired jurisdiction.
Not over the June Defs and not over City Mortgage. There was never any jurisdiction over June Defs and City Mortgage in this case. They were never served. They were not joined as a party. That's the problem here. Although they were not served and not joined as parties in this case, there was an order entered affecting their property interests, affecting the most fundamental right that they have, which is due process of law. And the fact that Mr. Hicks will undoubtedly argue that, well, so what? No harm, no foul. That is not the rule. You do not look at jurisdictional issues, and you don't look at due process issues about whether or not there was a good defense or bad defense or that would have prevailed had they been joined or not prevailed. That is not the inquiry of this court. The question is the fundamental process by which we were denied due process in this case.
So your argument, I gather, is that where there has been an additional party who has acquired an interest in the property upon which there is a lien, okay?
Yes.
That the court lacks jurisdiction to revive that absent the joinder of the party who is now the interest holder in the property. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely correct. You know, we've got this backwards in this case. Due process requires notice and an opportunity to come forward and present your position in court. Because your interest is at risk, you're entitled to that notice and you're entitled to present your position. Here, knowing that Mr. Grubbs had no interest whatsoever in this property, had been discharged in bankruptcy, gave notice to the one party who didn't have any interest whatsoever in the issue that was before the trial court. knowing that the June Devs and City Mortgage were the parties who really had an interest in this property and who would be affected by this revival motion, he denied or failed to give them notice. He says, I didn't have to give them notice because Rule 54H doesn't require me to give them notice. Well, there's some question about that, but in any event, the statute which is controlling here, which is 1352.102.1, says that a judgment lien must be revived as provided by law. It does not say as provided under Rule 54H, and in fact, Rule 54H's primary thrust is a revival of a judgment, not a judgment lien. So we've got a classic case of knowing who had the interest in the property. No notice was given to them in this case. They were indispensable under both the definition under Rule 24 and Rule 19 to the determination of the issues in this case. They were not given notice. That failure to give notice rendered the original revival motion to be void as a matter of law. That must be vacated. We've cited the authority that says that this is not a question of discretion. This is a question of mandatory vacation, and that's Lobato versus Taylor and several other cases that we've cited to you in the brief. That is very clear. This is not a discretionary issue with the trial court. It is a mandatory issue. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, please.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Max Stitch. With me at council table is Fred Skillern. We're from the law firm of Montgomery, Little, Soren, and Murray, and we represent the appellee, Donald Hicks. At its basic essence, the court is being presented with the issue of whether or not it should affirm or reverse the trial court's decision with respect to a revival proceeding. We submit to you that based on the fact that the appellants have shown absolutely no substantive basis whatsoever for denying the revival, and based on the fact that the appellants, as they sit here today, are in the exact same position that they were when they purchased the Glenmore property, and last, based on the fact that Donald Hicks strictly complied with the requirements of Rule 54, that this court affirm the trial court's decision.
Counsel, how can you argue that they have not been adversely affected? Had the revival proceeding not commenced, there'd be no lien on the property today.
That is correct.
So, it seems to me to say that, as the trial court did, that this didn't hurt them at all, is simply a flight from reality.
Well, what I'm saying is their position today, after the revival order, the only difference is...
I understand that, but I'm saying, but for the revival order, they would have been adversely affected. I mean, they were adversely affected by the revival order.
Well, the revival order, I would argue to you that the revival order maintains the status quo. When they purchased the property, on their title commitment, they knew there was a $400,000 lien. And the idea that they're banking on us not to revive the lien, as provided by law, Colorado law is clear, 1352.102 and Rule 54 clearly give a judgment creditor the ability to prolong and to extend the life of a lien, especially in a circumstance like this, where there's no dispute that Mr. Hicks, he's been trying to collect on his lien. He's been trying, and he's gone to the Supreme Court once against the Laundres, and he's in front of the Supreme Court now against the Judas. He's been trying, and based on those proceedings, 6 years has elapsed. So he used his statutory rights to prolong the life of the lien that the Judas and City Mortgage knew about. They knew the date the judgment was entered, they knew the case in which it was entered, and they knew exactly when it needed to be revived. And all Mr. Hicks did was use his legal rights to maintain his lien so that he could continue to collect upon a valid judgment that he obtained. And quite honestly, to the converse of this, if the court decides to deny the revival order and to vacate the trial court's decisions, and if this lien is removed from the June Defs property, the June Defs assume an enormous windfall. This lien that they knew was on their property, is no longer encumbering the property, a $400,000 lien. And on this other side, Mr. Hicks, who has a bargained for judgment. In 2001, he was defrauded for hundreds of thousands of dollars by Mr. Gomes.
Counsel, the underlying question of whether the lien should or should not be revived is not involved here. The question is whether or not the Juniffs are entitled to be heard before the court makes that decision. Isn't that the issue?
Well, that's the issue that the appellants have raised. In the trial court's decision, the appellants were heard. They filed numerous motions. Now, granted, that was after the revival order was issued.
And the evidence presumably is to the effect that they had no knowledge of the motion to revive.
They weren't served with notice of it. They had knowledge of the case when they purchased the property. They could have intervened at any time. They knew that there was going to be a revival proceeding. I mean, we initiated that revival proceeding a year before the judgment would expire, but at that time, the law in the state of Colorado under the May decision was draconian. And if you didn't revive the judgment by the sixth year, you missed out. So we started the proceeding early to make sure that we had the revival order prior to the six-year expiration date. But to say that the Juniffs had no idea this was going on, I wouldn't buy that argument, because they knew of the lawsuit. They knew the lien affected their property. They knew it was encumbering their property. Hicks was involved in a parallel lawsuit trying to foreclose on his lien in Arapahoe District Court, which was then appealed to this court, which has subsequently been appealed to the Supreme Court. They knew full well that Hicks's intentions were to foreclose on this lien. And they knew full well that in 6 years, this lien was going to expire. And the idea that they were banking on as somehow not reviving the lien, I don't think that argument holds any weight. Now, were they given notice of it? Did we serve them in accordance with Rule 4? No. But Rule 54 doesn't require that. As counsel for the appellant stated, Rule 13-52-102 is what clearly allows for judgment liens. It provides, and it states that in order to revive the judgment lien, which expires in 6 years, you need to revive it in accordance with law. The only law that we have to revive a lien is under Rule 54. And Rule 54 is basically a pro forma proceeding. It is not a new lawsuit. The only defenses that an objecting party would have under Rule 54 to revival is that the judgment has been paid, that there isn't a judgment, or two, that the judgment is somehow void. And at the trial court level and at this court, they've presented no evidence. They presented no substantive basis and no substantive rationale for denying the revival order.
But that's because the trial court refused to allow them to do that.
They filed multiple motions in the trial
court. I understand that, but the trial court said, no, I'm not going to vacate it because your due process rights were not denied, and therefore you're not entitled to be heard on the merits.
Sure. But it's not as if they haven't argued the validity of the lien. First, the Laundres, the first purchasers of the Glenmore property after Hicks, they fought the validity of the underlying judgment. The trial court, the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court all found against the Laundres with respect to the validity of the underlying judgment. When the Juniffs purchased the property, they fought the exact same issue, saying the underlying lien was procured by extortion and criminal threats.
And you're saying presumably that the prior judgments are binding upon them because they're successor in interest.
Correct. And we have res judicata. They've already litigated the issue. A panel of this court recently issued the Hicks versus Juniff opinion, and there's a specific provision in that decision with a specific heading that says that the lien is valid, that the underlying judgment is valid. So the only arguments that they've raised with this court are procedural inadequacies, and they have no basis for attacking the underlying revival order. And with that, what that amounts to at most would be harmless error. And as you brought up, Judge Criswell, is the Rule 19 argument. Rule 19 has never been applied at all to any post-judgment proceedings. In fact, if you look at the basis of Rule 54, Rule 54 is very clear as to how you get a judgment lien or a judgment for 20 years or a judgment lien for 6 years, how you get that extended so that you can continue your collection process. It tells you, it tells the creditor when they need to file the motion. It tells the clerk of court what to do after the motion is filed. And then it goes so far as to tell the trial court what to do after the debtor fails to respond, to revive the judgment. It's not a new trial. The revival proceeding, the revival proceeding was set up not to allow judgment debtors or other interested parties to relitigate the matter. If that were the case, there would be a significant advantage for any judgment debtor who has a lien on their property to not pay their debts, because they know in 6 years if they can relitigate the matter and relitigate the validity of the underlying judgment and not adhere to the principles of finality, that their chances of success in 6 years are going to be much greater than they were when the judgment was initially entered. Rule 54 is a simple formality for the creditor, especially in a situation like this, where collection efforts have been attempted and have been appealed and have been ongoing, to simply maintain the judgment lien for an extended period of time. And
can I ask you a question?
Sure.
The argument seems to be that under 1352.101, unlike Rule 54H, it has the language as provided by law. And they use that phrase to include due process and argue that they were denied due process because they were not provided notice. How do you respond to that?
Well, the Colorado case law has stated, and I believe it's in the recent Robbins decision from the Supreme Court, that provided by law, there's only one way to revive a judgment in this state, and that's under Rule 54. And Rule 54 spells out how you revive that judgment. And to put additional requirements on litigants to have foresight as to give notice to anyone that could possibly have an interest in this property is simply unfair and does not comply with Rule 54, that specifically states the judgment debtor is the only one that needs to receive notice to show cause.
Why isn't there a due process argument when a party has a property interest in the property you're trying to attach the judgment lien to?
Well, I mean, when the Supreme Court created the rule, that's the way they created it. I suppose the rationale would be, if you're ever going to revive a lien and you need to give notice to anyone who has an interest in the property, within those 6 years it could be numerous people, and you're putting an enormous burden on the creditor. The creditor simply wants to extend their rights to collect on this lien. Well, that's all it's doing. It's not a new lawsuit. It's just extending the lien for six additional years.
What is the onerous burden of getting an O&E just before you file your motion to revive?
What is the owner's burden before we file our motion to revive?
To see who has an interest in this property now.
Well, the owner, before we filed the motion to revive, knew Donald Hicks had an interest.
My question is, as a general matter, what would be so onerous to require a judgment creditor who seeks to revive of simply finding out whether or not there is a new ownership interest in the property that is subject to the judgment lien? How's that onerous?
It's not onerous, but it's not required under the rules. When the Supreme Court wrote the rule, they made it explicit. Rule 54, only person you need to give notice to is the judgment debtor.
But isn't the issue here then whether or not Rule 54 squares, if you will, with due process?
That is the issue that the appellants have raised.
Okay.
And in this situation, what we're looking at really is a case where all we have, no matter what, even if they had notice, amounts to harmless error, because they have no ability whatsoever to attack the validity of the underlying judgment. They provided no case law. They provided no law at all that says an interested party can collaterally attack a judgment against another party.
All right, let me ask you this question, counsel, and that's because I haven't read the record. Did the motions that were filed set forth the bases for their desire, their position that the judgment should not or the judgment lien or judgment should not be revived?
The motions that were filed, and from the top of my head, was initially a motion to intervene with a motion to dismiss under Rule 60 if the judgment was void. And then the second motion was the failure to join an indispensable party.
So they did file a motion directed to the bases for, the substantive bases for their assertion that the revival order should not be entered.
Well,
the Rule 60.
They didn't provide a substantive basis. I don't believe, and I don't have it off the top of my head right now, and I'm sure Mr. Hamill will be able to answer this question better. When they filed their motion to intervene and to vacate under Rule 60, I'm not 100% positive if they argued that the underlying judgment was void and that that was the substantive basis they were using to defeat the revival proceeding. Either way, that would have been a fruitless argument, as a panel of this court has already determined there is a valid lien on the property. And there's also no support that they can even collaterally attack it in a post-judgment proceeding. And I guess since I only have a short time left, the last thing that I wanted to talk about is just something briefly that the trial court really grasped a hold of, and that is really that they're in the same position now as they were before. And to find and to reverse this order and to vacate the revival order would be the end of Hicks's case. It would be punishing Hicks for following the strict letter of the law. He followed Rule 54. He had his judgment revived. And if that order is now vacated, he has no other way to collect. And to the contrary, it would allow the Junedefs, who knew of this judgment when they purchased the property, an enormous windfall because the $400,000 lien would no longer be there. So with that said, I would ask that the court affirm the trial court's decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hamill, you have about a little over 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The same argument persists. No harm, no foul. That is not what this case is about. And to answer your question, Judge Criswell, in the original pleadings filed, motions filed in this case, the substantive issue of the validity of the judgment was not raised. And
how could it be?
That's the whole point. Why would we have to raise it? The issue is not whether there was a basis upon which to set aside the prior judgment lien. The issue is whether or not we got due process of law.
But I understood you earlier to say that the basis for your objection that would have been asserted to the revival motion was lack of jurisdiction.
That would
avoid judgment. And I'm asking you, how can that issue be raised at this point?
That would be the same kind of thing of saying, if my bank sued me without serving me and got a judgment against me on a clear and obviously liable promissory note, that I could not come in and raise the question of procedural due process to attack that judgment. It's simply not the law. It is not a question of no harm, no foul. It's a question of compliance with constitutional requirements of giving us notice. It's interesting to note, for example, under Rule 54H, that if there was going to be a revival of this judgment, service of process, in accordance with Rule 4, had to be made upon the judgment debtor. That's the only thing it says in there. It doesn't talk about other parties in interest, but it doesn't in any other way counteract the idea that, vitiate the idea that you have to comply with due process. Rule 4 obviously requires personal service. Mr. Hicks got personal service on Mr. Grubbs, who was already subject to the jurisdiction of this court. He elected not to get personal service on the two parties that he knew had an interest in this property. For him to now come before the court and say it's inequitable to stick him with his decision is simply wrong. The hidden valley case, the hidden the Hidden Lake development case is right on point. And it basically said, look, if you're going to go in and start a lawsuit and do it in violation of some party's due process of law, don't come in and complain to us that you've now lost your cause of action. That was your choice that you made. There was nothing burdensome about giving notice to either the Junedefs or City Mortgage.
But this wasn't a new cause of action.
It's not a new cause of action, but it is a new cause of action in the sense that it imposes upon the title of the Junedefs and the interests of City Mortgage, a new encumbrance.
But Hidden Valley was a pre-judgment failure to join.
Hidden Valley was not a pre-judgment failure to join because Hidden Valley involved the appeal under Rule 106 of a zoning ordinance.
Well, of course, and that's a new proceeding under 106A4, and before the court entered an order, they failed to join the party initially.
But that is exactly what happened here. Before the court entered the order reviving the judgment lien, there were, the June Defs and City Mortgage were not parties to this action. They had no notice of it. There has been nothing in the record that indicates they had no notice of it.
They knew there was a judgment lien outstanding.
Of course they knew there was a judgment lien. And they knew also, presumably, they knew also that that was of limited life. And they knew that if somebody wanted to renew that limited life, then by due process, they were required to give notice. I mean, I don't understand Mr. Hicks's problem here. He knew of their interests. He said, I'm just going to comply narrowly with this 54H, that requirement. That's it. I'm going to ignore due process. I'm going to ignore the fact that I know they have an interest in this property, which is going to be affected. And now he comes before this court, as he did before the trial court, and says, it is inequitable for me to lose my lien. He had all the right in the world to protect his lien. He may have prevailed on his motion to redo or to revive his lien. Had we been joined, we would have made it, whatever argument would have made. We might have won, we might have lost. That is not the issue. We were never given the opportunity. That's the issue in this case. It is one of pure constitutional right of due process. And that's what the decision of this court should turn upon. And by the decisions that we've cited in our brief, should reverse, should order that the revival motion was void and should be vacated as a matter of law. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. And this matter will stand submitted and an opinion will be issued in due course. Court will stand in recess and the bailiffs may so announce.
Court will be in recess, subject to call.